Please explain more. How did the Buddha cross the flood by neither going forward nor staying still? What does this mean? Well, I think the when the Buddha explains it himself, he says that when he pushed forward, as is I think the way it's translated, then he was swirled about, and when he stayed in place, then he sunk. So it's pointing to the middle way, so that by frantically investing huge amounts of effort, and doesn't necessarily mean one gets anywhere. Sometimes it just stirs you up even more. So that that's a problem. The staying still is that sinking in terms of dullness or a lack of investigation or a it could also be say pointing to a middle way of say the desire for being and becoming, so propping up that sense of being, but then sinking into non-being, annihilation. Those are common extremes that we go to as human beings, so that in order to, and the flood is a common idiom for samsara, so crossing the world. So. How could you accomplish studying Buddhism in Thailand with Lumpa Cha? How did Lumpa Cha teach you as you were a foreigner, a new monk? And how do you deal with the language issue? Well, part of it was in the words of Ajahn Chah, because oftentimes people would ask, especially Thai people would ask, how do you teach these foreigners? You know, they don't speak Thai and you don't speak English. How can you teach them? And Ajahn Chah said, well, it's easy. It's just like teaching buffalo. You pull them here, pull them there, and sooner or later they learn, you know. So if you can teach a buffalo, surely a human can learn something. Especially in Thai, it's just, when you say somebody's a buffalo, it's kind of it's not very complimentary. Also, I remember one time him explaining that, in the same way with, if you say, like if you had some warm water like this, and said, well, even something that's right there, if you use language, doesn't necessarily mean you can explain it. And so that, because in the Thai language, you'd say, Nam Ron. But then the language that they speak in Ubon, where Ajahn Chah was, they don't even use that language. It's Nam Ron. And then English is hot water, and then French would be something else, Chinese would be something else. All these languages, and All it is just some warm water. So that language isn't necessarily going to explain much. And really, Dhamma is not about language. He said what you have to do is just stick your finger in. Then you'll know what warm water's like. He said that's because Dhamma is not about the words, about the concepts, about the ideas. It's about the experience. So that you have to give people the opportunity to have the experience of happiness and suffering, peace and all the range of human experience. That's what you'll, and the language of Dhamma is this sense of what is cool and peaceful. So just by, a lot of it is with example that Dajahn Chah taught. And also it took a lot of patience to study there. Because even that's like in as I was saying that like the especially when I first got there, I tried to went out and bought books and dictionaries of the Thai language to learn Thai as much as I could, and then. And I was in central Thailand for quite some time, so I put a lot of effort into trying to learn Thai language. And then I get up to Ajahn Chah's monastery, and he doesn't speak Thai. It's a Laotian dialect, and there's no books. The first few years, just trying to figure out the dialect, and so learning the best teachers, best language teachers were the novices, the young novices in the monastery. They're young guys, young kids who are in. Oftentimes they get sent there by their parents because they're naughty and completely unruly at home. And they're young, they're teenagers, so they're restless. And so they tend to have the patience and the time to teach and explain the language a bit more. The monks were often out there, just go back to their kuti and meditate. You don't see them so much. So that, just learning over time. And that was a lot of the time. And then, but over time, by having learned, say, Thai language and getting a good sense of the local dialect, then you get a real good feel for the teachings, and particularly the over time, then more and more central Thai people started coming. There was more, for most of the time that I was there, there was probably more Westerners than there were central Thais at Ajahn Chah's monastery. So it was, but oftentimes there are a lot of visitors coming. So over time, then Ajahn Chah started speaking Central Thai and teaching in Central Thai more. So that was helpful. Okay. You often talk about gladdening and lightening the mind. How do I do that? Many thanks for your teachings. Part of it is there's many aspects to it. I mean, part of, when I say gladdening in the mind is just not taking yourself so seriously is one. I mean, sometimes we take my practice and me and what I'm getting and trying to get, and that becomes very burdensome. Learning how to lighten up a bit about practice. But also bringing to mind, and this is where using discursive themes, using thought, because bringing to mind generosity, giving, sharing, loving kindness practices, compassion practices, bringing to mind the opportunities for gratitude, appreciation. Sympathetic joy, mudita, like taking. Mudita is the opportunity, delighting in the goodness of others, or the good fortune of others, or the accomplishments of others, and especially in extremely competitive culture like America, that doesn't happen so often, or it's not. Usually default option. But it's really something to contemplate, because if all we're doing is practicing, thinking about our own progress and accomplishments and what we're getting out of the practice, there's only one of us, and there's like 7 billion other people on the planet, and just the odds are somebody's doing something good. So I mean, it just ups your odds a lot to expand your scope, rather than it being about me. That lightens the mind, and it's really giving that opportunity. Objects of devotion, recollecting Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, really gladdens the mind how fortunate we are to come in contact with these teachings. So there's many, many ways of directing attention and bringing to mind things that lighten the mind. Also, just even in terms of lightening the mind, the perception of light is really bringing in on you. Because sometimes, it's easy for the mind to kind of collapse in itself and gets really dark. But to really perception of light, bringing up that bringing to mind light. Sitting with one's eyes open, letting light in, visualizing light or color, it really brightens the mind. So, lots and lots of ways. Okay. Could you speak a little about the structure of the Pali Canon? How much was written down in the Buddha's time? Actually, there was nothing written down in the Buddha's time. It was all committed to memory. And India was predominantly an oral culture. And particularly for religious and spiritual teachings, even into modern times now, the the Hindu tradition, they're trained from a very young age, the Brahmins, in the priestly caste, are trained from a very, very young age of committing things to memory and learning, being able to listen and remember. It's a capacity of the mind that is. So it can be developed, and certainly was at the time of the Buddha, so that the writing was known at the time. I mean, what writing was used at the time, but it wasn't considered something that you'd do for a religious text or religious teachings. That it was like writing and sort of written language. It was more for business and for religious teachings. So it was considered kind of demeaning to write it down, to venerate it. You committed it to memory and passed it on. So it was an object of devotion. So that for several hundred years after the Buddha passed away, the scriptures were committed to memory and passed on. And it's also the origin of chanting. Because one of the ways of memorization is reciting, and you recite out loud. And then to check, there were councils from time to time where the monks from different areas would come together, and then they would recite together the scriptures. And you had reciters and then listeners. And you listen for discrepancies. And when there was a discrepancy, then you stop. And then you have to go back and figure out what's the discrepancy? Why is there? How to resolve that? And so that there's a so the maintaining of a fairly accurate account of the Buddha's teachings, because sometimes I think in modern view is that it wasn't written down for hundreds of years, who knows what they were doing. But it's more the other way around. They started writing it down, well, who knows what they were doing. it's a lot more scope for changing things. So the structure of the Pali Canon is... it's actually called Tipitaka, which is like three baskets. And basket of the, say, the books of discipline, baskets of the suttas or the spoken word of the Buddha, and the baskets of the Abhidhamma, which are a much later... addition, more like commentarial literature. And it's considered integral to the teachings from a historical perspective, but in terms of, say, at the time of the Buddha, what was there were the instructions on the training, rules of training, conduct, procedures for maintaining communal harmony, and then the teachings, of course, that the Buddha gave over 45 years. So a lot was committed to memory and passed on. And then when it was written down, then it was maybe codified a bit more. There's lots of murky areas that are still being, trying to figure out what are the layers of the Pali Canon, what are the earlier teachings, which ones were additional, and there's raging controversies in scholarly articles and whatnot. But I think there's enough of the teachings in the Pali Canon to get a confident basis of, oh yeah, this is what the historical Buddha taught. Okay, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Dependent Origination, advice on all sorts of different aspects of training and teaching and living. Could you talk about women's ordination and nuns during the Buddha's time and in modern times, so that in the Buddha's time, I'm not 100% sure how long after the Buddha established the first, beginning with the five ascetics that one sees in the Dhammacakka, but those were the first religious seekers who took ordination. Could be maybe because it was the Buddha was several years before he went back to visit his home country, territory, and then it was after that some years after that, a few years after that, that because the first nun was his stepmother, along with a large group of the Sakyan, his clan, nobles, noble women. And so then a woman's ordination was established, an order, they lived in separate communities, but had very, very similar training and lifestyle. Over time, about 1,000 or more years after the Buddha passed away, then the Bhikkhuni order slowly disappeared, and in modern times it's being reestablished, the first ordinations took place. I think they actually, because it was the Sri Lankan, I'm not sure if they took place in Sri Lanka or in Bodh Gaya, but they were, so that there's a begun with from Sri Lanka anyway, and then establishing itself slowly, there's enough interest in certainly in the West as well as in Sri Lanka, in Thailand. There's even though, say, on culturally, or not, maybe not culturally, but or traditionally, it's not not common. But there's several communities starting to establish. It's actually they don't have legal support, but there. And that's one of the interesting things in Thailand that. And really, if somebody's practicing keeping virtuous conduct and is sincere, that they will get supported, and that's happening. So it will, you know, I think that certainly in terms of a modern times, it's something that is needed, and it'll happen. It is happening. Can you talk a little about the role memory plays in perception? well, yeah, because that's the we use the word perception, but the root of the word perception is in memory. And because the way that in the Thai language, the word sanya has two parallel or complementary meanings, and one is memory and giving meaning to something, so that that association and say what we perceive is based on the memories that we have, so that we it's just when we remember something, we are also giving it some kind of importance or meaning in some way, whether it's positive or negative or whatever. But there's an association that we have with it. So that's a function of perception. It's how we perceive something. And it relies on memory to keep a certain amount, that's information going as to what was that? Was that a good experience? Was that a bad experience? Was it helpful? Was it not helpful? Is that something to be feared? Is it something to be that I like, that I want more of? So that is the function of memory in order to help perceive something as having. What do I need to know about it? Okay, I'm concerned about Alzheimer's disease and getting stuck between life and death, losing all I've learned about mindfulness practice and all my dignity. Where is the silver lining in this life's challenge? Well, you know, I think, you know, certainly with some things with Alzheimer's or a lot of it is cognitive function, memory, but there's certain aspects of our being that aren't really, because even when we talk about mindfulness, it's more like, it's a bit more of a higher cognitive function, whereas a fundamental awareness and a certain quality of being. So one of the there's a monk that I know, and I've known him for many years and over time, and actually the last time I saw him, which was a year or so before he passed away, but he was his Alzheimer's was kicking in, and he was didn't have we had to look after him, keep an eye on him because he'd wander off, and his presence was quite just absolutely delightful. And I remember saying to one of the monks that I was with, saying, you know, I want to be like that when I'm sort of, you know, in my wheelchair drooling. And just, just be, you know, be kind of warm. And he was even though he has sort of kind of executive functions were completely challenged, his presence was extremely warm and bright. And I think that's the sort of thing that doesn't, you know, isn't touched through our practice. We're really fundamentally laying a foundation of, in a deeper strata of our being with this practice. So that's something like, you know, there's the other side of, you know, there's really a lot that I just don't need to, it would be nice to not have to remember. It'd be a real break. Please explain the hierarchy of devas, gods, etc. in relation to the Buddha. How is it that a mortal being can be more evolved and enlightened than gods? Do gods and devas create karma? Are they born again as gods or devas or humans? And I'm not much on cosmology, in terms of, you know, say the traditional cosmology, the different realms of beings. Say the human realm is seen as ideal for awakening because of the the experience of both happiness and suffering, and the ability to make choices, skillful choices, and the rebirth as say devas, gods, because there's a whole sort of a hierarchy of devas. It was like in the chant that we did this morning. of the Dhammacakka Sutta, where these devas are delighting in the Buddha's teaching. They're delighting in it, but they're not practicing it. They're going back. Great! There's a Buddha in the world. Pass me to something else to eat or drink. change the channel. The realm of devas, of gods, are exceedingly pleasurable, so that it's seen as a, from say a Buddhist perspective, seen as a hindrance. It's pleasant, but it's not optimal for cultivation. Deva realms, celestial realms, are seen as realms of reaping the fruits of karma as opposed to creating karma. Again, that's the human realm is where karma is most easily or most directly created. Gods and devas it's not a permanent realm, so that they are born again, and this is where, say, it's in terms of karma and rebirth, the Buddha saying that our actions, the karma that is created, ripens either in this life or the next life or some future life. I mean, it's just this, it extends out over long periods of time, a deva realm exceedingly pleasant, but then someday they could be reborn as another deva, they could be reborn as humans, they can take rebirth in a lower realm. Everything's up for grabs. If a layperson wants to follow the seventh precept in daily life, refraining from entertainment seems fairly straightforward. Would you please explain more specifically refraining from beautification and adornment? Does owning artwork fall anywhere into precept 7? Never ever thought of it. But usually when say that beautification and adornment is usually around cosmetics and jewelry and... And if you see, in artwork from India, and also the first accounts of the Westerners going to India, India was extremely, I mean, that's the British drooled over India. They stripped it of as much as they could out there. Because it was extremely wealthy, beautification and adornment in terms of cosmetics, jewelry, male and female was very ordinary. So it's more cosmetics, jewelry, I never really thought of. Artwork, I've never even heard it really talked about as a part of a precept. think part of it, it could be, I mean, sort of sometimes you can extrapolate from precepts, and extrapolate principles, sort of say, okay, as a principle, a lot of the purpose of the precepts is simplification, and it also depends on what the purpose of artwork. Sometimes artwork is religious artwork, which is a devotional and soothing. Sometimes it's kind of blatant consumption and competition. I mean, those are two polar opposites of say a purpose of artwork. So that a lot of it is when one starts extrapolating at principles, you know, we look, okay, there's a purpose of the precept is to create kind of a simplicity, a certain renunciation, especially those like the eight precepts are renunciant precepts, so that explicitly fostering that sense of simplicity, ease of looking after oneself and being looked after. Thank you for expanding on the function of consciousness and how we suffer. During my walking meditation, I went so slow and felt become aware of consciousness arising with every speck of movement, touch, etc. I saw consciousness would be a nutriment, as if it's bait for the rats, except the rats thrive on it and proliferate. I also saw the rat being the self arising and taking ownership, moving towards suffering. Dispassion, wow, what an antidote to the self. It remains to be seen how this insight can be kept lit as we move into interaction. So, great, because that's exactly that sense of how the nutriment, what we nourish, things with, and particularly that, that nutriment, nourishing of that which creates more complication and difficulty, and you realize, oh, well, I can actually be feeding something else. I mean, I can be feeding what's peaceful, what's settling, what's cooling, what's expansive. So recognizing how that works, and it's something that is so basic to our existence. Yeah, the Buddha sort of said, all beings exist nutriment. Sort of, oh, yeah, right. But then you sort of see, you start teasing that out, and it starts the implications get kind of interesting. Okay, great. Okay, please demonstrate how to bow. Are there any cultural differences? Positions of hands, elbows, head. Is the behind up in the air or down? Please keep it down. Keep it down. yeah, I can do a tutorial right here, because it's not the and there are cultural differences. There's a bow in, say, Theravada countries, there's bows in Mahayana countries, there's bows in Vajrayana countries, and they do it quite differently. But I'll teach you an Ajahn Chah bow, As I can remember one time, there was an ordination, and a candidate was coming from a branch monastery for Ajahn Chah to be the preceptor and give his ordination. And so that very first come in and to start the process of ordination. And of course, the first thing you do is bow. And Ajahn Chah said, "No, no, 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 no." sometimes Ajahn Chah could be merciless. And poor guy got so flustered, and Ajahn Chah was really on him. Because I think a lot of it was not so much on the person who was coming to ordain, but it was the Ajahn who brought him and didn't train him how to bow properly. And so that, so I remember sitting there, and just, oh, that poor guy. But Ajahn Chah was, you know, it's like this, it's not like that. But I'll bow right here, just sort of in this direction. There's a couple different ways. I mean, one is say on one's haunches like that, or like that, whichever is comfortable. A lot of people find that up on your toes like that can be a bit painful. But that's especially in monasteries and in Thai culture, and especially in the countryside. And this is how you grow up doing this, so that it's just really ordinary. Either up on one's toes like that, or down like that. And bringing the hands together at the kind of the heart level, and then raising the hands in Anjali to the forehead, and then bending from the hips, and then the elbows are beside the knees, the hands slightly apart, and keep your butt down. And then bring the forehead down, touch the ground, and then coming up to the chest, the heart area, up to the forehead. The second time, bowing a third time. And then as one finishes, just making it a mindful action where Ajahn Chah, it's actually a feature of Ajahn Chah's monastery. They bow a lot. Because he would train us to... One is you come into a shrine room, you come into a place of a practice, and the first thing you bow. You go back to your dwelling place, and you put your robes down, you bow. You go to leave your dwelling place. Before you leave, you bow. So that bowing is, you know, on a given day, you bow a lot. I remember Westerner who came. You know, Lumpa, why do we bow so much here? It's just really, it just seems excessive. And Ajahn Chah said, oh, it's good exercise, good for your health. But it's, to me, it's a really, one, it's a beautiful gesture. Two, it's a nice way of composing oneself. You come into the hall and you compose yourself. Also, just that we end a session and we bow. And it's beginnings and endings are really important. How we do things, because that's tends to that's what carries on. So that you come shuffling into the shrine room and slump down in a heap, well, it has a different feeling than coming in mindfully and bowing. You get up to leave and you sort of. It has a different feeling if you finish your meditation and say, "Oh yeah, I got to do this." Bow, and then you go, and so it sets a tone that you can carry through. There's a continuity in one's practice. That's very helpful. As I've been pondering about consciousness as nutriment, which pointed me to the self, I'm wondering, is the self, is attachment? But attachment is not permanent either. So, could we say the self can be either attachment and, or non-attachment, the owner or non-owner, not trying to find self, rather understanding self, perhaps pure self as opposed to impure self? Please comment. I think one of the I think part of the sometimes with the English language there's say that sense of the idea of self is so strong. Actually, not even English language, it's kind of a modern, somewhat modern concept, the whole idea of self. It's only really gained a huge momentum in our culture, slightly over 100 years. So it's a, but it's recognizing that, obviously we have a reference point, a sense of I. Take it out of the realm of self and pay attention to suffering or not suffering. That's much more useful. That speculation about self, or speculation about not self, speculation about a pure self, speculation about an impure self, that goes on forever. But to bring it to a place of what is there, what's the experience? Is there peace and clarity? Is there some kind of agitation? Some kind of fear, movement of that compulsion. What's driving that? Where's that? Is there suffering or not suffering? That's a much more fruitful. And it's of course that's exactly what the Buddha was teaching in his first discourse. He's come back to that. That's where the Four Noble Truths. Gives us the opportunity to approach our experience as human beings, step out of the kind of the dichotomy of self and other, being and non-being, and look in terms of dukkha, cessation of dukkha, and that optimizes one's opportunity for the experience of cessation of dukkha. Thank you so much for morning instructions. I was a little confused this morning about the nutriments. I'm assuming the nutriments nourish our suffering. They do. They don't have to. In the sense, our spiritual practice has to be nourished as well. Our aspiration for happiness and liberation has to be nourished also. It cuts both ways. Anyway, what I wrote down, I'm not sure it's correct. Sensual contact or sensory contact, mental volition, consciousness. So that the four nutriments are material food, but it's the understanding of material food, it can highlight and give us the opportunity to understand is those five chords of sensual pleasure or sense desire, understanding the realm of the senses and how that works. And the second one is contact, which is passa, which is both a sense contact, but it's also contact within the mind. It's not just external contact, it's an internal contact. Passa is and what that can highlight and give us the opportunity to understand is feeling. So pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neutral feeling, vedana. Because it's that passa vedana usually then it leads on to, it keeps rolling, it keeps proliferating. We react to the feeling that we experience. The Buddha said that the untrained mind tends to react out of desire when it experiences pleasant feeling, reacts with aversion when it experiences unpleasant feeling, and reacts with delusion when it experiences the neutral. But with that nutriment, and then of course they were seeking contact. It's just as part of the human condition. So just to learn to understand, so that we're not blindly reacting. Mental volition is that intention, volition, movement of mind, when we really understand that, then we get a window of insight or clarity on the three forms of desire: sensual desire, desire for being, becoming, existence, and then desire for non-being, for annihilation. So, kama tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. And then consciousness, the nutriment of being something, then we build up the associate them, that name and form is what we can understand. Nama rupa, the materiality, mentality that really forms or coalesces into me being something. So that's what we can understand. Okay. Yesterday's question about the quote unquote wind element reminded me of one of your favorite teachings from the Dhamma of Winnie the Pooh. Something about a storm and a conversation between Pooh and Piglet. Would you mind refreshing my recollection? Or if the reference doesn't ring a bell, perhaps another of Pooh's many nuggets of wisdom to inspire. Well, I'll tell you a story. So Piglet and Pooh were walking out in the 100-acre wood, and there was a storm came up, and the wind was blowing, and wind's blowing and howling, and branches are sort of blowing past them, the leaves are swirling around, and Piglet, who of course has a very strong fear temperament, starts to get very worried, and Pooh, what would happen if this wind were blowing and a big branch fell down on us? And Pooh thought for a bit. I said, what if it didn't? So. Can you clarify the difference between a desire and an intention? It seems that either could lead to suffering due to attachment to the results, yet we are encouraged to have intentions for well-being, health, happiness, etc. Isn't our intention also a desire? This is where I'll hopefully not make you glaze over with technical terms of Buddhism, but there's distinctions. Again, this is where sometimes because English is not a technical spiritual language, and you know, we use the language that we have, but an intention. In Pali is jetana, and jetana is maybe volition is probably a better word, but it's a movement of mind in a certain direction. So that volition, we're setting a course of intention, volition, movement towards a thought or something, or trying to some sort of goal for either body, speech, or mind. And all action for it to have some karmic potential has jetana as a part of that. So, desire is more nuanced in the sense that, say, like in the Dhammacakka Sutta, which we recited this morning, the Buddha pointed to desire as the cause of suffering. So, desire in this sense being tanha, so sensual desire, desire for being, desire for non-being, gama tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. Tanha is a form of desire that is always bound up with greed, hatred, and delusion, and always results in suffering. That's the nature of that form of desire. There's another word in Pali for desire also, which is chanda. And chanda is more neutral, but is generally a positive force. So that in the, say, the 37 wings to awakening, there are different sets of the Buddha's teachings. And the very first one is the four bases of success, so the four bases of spiritual success. And the first base of spiritual success is chanda, and chanda is desire. So that without desire, without a wholesome desire, without a positive desire, we don't do much. We need to, and so maybe a better word is motivation, or interest. I use different words sometimes, but its fundamental meaning is like desire. And it can have negative connotations sometimes, so that in the five hindrances, the first one, sensual desire, is kama chanda. So that has a negative connotation. But then, as I said, chanda on its own, in that four bases of spiritual success, is a very positive force. There's also dhamma chanda, the desire for Dhamma, desire for truth. Kusala chanda, desire for the good, for the wholesome. So that chanda is something that we need to cultivate in its positive, but it's wholesome. So that we are able to motivate ourselves to practice, and then direct our energy. And because also the natural result of chanda is effort, is putting forth energy. When we have desire for something, then we're willing to put forth effort. And that's especially in terms of, say, the four bases of spiritual success. Chanda, virya, citta, vimamsa. So chanda as desire, virya as effort, citta as the establishing of the mind, applying the mind, and vimamsa as reviewing, reflecting, investigating. What worked, what didn't work, what was helpful, how does it work? And then when that's functioning, usually it's, say, the result of that investigation or reviewing, it's going to bring up more desire, more chanda. So it's it's a positive feedback loop. Okay, last one. Oh, lovely. Okay, I'm grateful to be attending this insightful retreat with its excellent teachings and models of diligent practice. This former seemingly lifelong prisoner to sloth and torpor is rejoicing in newly uncovered energy with gratitude to the Triple Gem. Sadhu. Okay, we'll have a bit of a break and then come back for puja.